From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. A landmark victory for gun rights supporters at the Supreme Court today. In a 6-3 ruling, the court struck down a more than 100-year-old New York law that limited carrying guns in public. It's the court's first big Second Amendment case in more than a decade. And it comes after a number of horrific mass shootings and as Congress negotiates bipartisan legislation on guns. President Biden said he was deeply disappointed by the ruling. Let's bring in Daryl Miller, Duke University law professor and co-director of the Duke Center for Firearms Law. Hi there.
Hi.
So I'm going to ask you to walk us through some complicated constitutional law in a way I can understand it. The New York law required people to show proper cause in order to get a license to carry a firearm in public. Now, writing for the majority, Justice Clarence Thomas said that requirement of proper cause, quote, violates the 14th Amendment by preventing law-abiding citizens with ordinary self-defense needs from exercising their right to keep and bear arms in public. The 14th Amendment, of course, is a civil rights law. Can you explain this?
The 14th Amendment ratified in 1868 part of Reconstruction. And the reason why he's citing the 14th Amendment is a technical issue about how the Bill of Rights, the first eight amendments to the United States Constitution, how they apply to regulate or limit what states and localities can do. So that's really the reason why. It's a Second Amendment case. The reason why the 14th Amendment is being cited is it's the 14th Amendment that makes the Second Amendment applicable to state regulations and to local regulations.
So Justice Stephen Breyer wrote for the dissent, saying the court was expanding gun rights without dealing with the, quote, nature or severity of firearms violence. What kind of impact is this ruling expected to have? How broad is it?
Well, on the issue about licensing, it's going to affect maybe about six states that have a licensing rule like New York's. But on the broader issue about how do you even figure out whether something violates the Second Amendment, this is a blockbuster. And the reason why is because the court essentially says that the kind of evidence that legislatures have been using to defend their regulations based on, you know, psychology or criminological data, all that is not as relevant as the text, history, and tradition of the Second Amendment. So now, not just licensing regulations, but all regulations will have to go through this analysis by which somebody tries to figure out how does a 21st century regulation look in some way analogous to an 18th century regulation.
So you said this specifically would affect six states. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote in his concurring opinion that 43 states that use a different standard for licensing may continue to do so. So those six states, states like New York, how do their licensing requirements differ from these 43 states that have shall issue requirements, something like Colorado or Arizona?
Right. So a shall issue is essentially a more limited way of figuring out whether to issue the license to the licensing authority. In New York, you had to show something called proper cause. And proper cause had a lot of discretionary elements to it based on what the licensing authority understood your need to be. Shall issue usually requires some kind of more objective metrics. Some sort of maybe training requirements, some other kind of showing that is more objective and less discretionary on the part of the licensing authority. And the court was very careful to say that nothing about the opinion implicates these states with shall issue regulations. So I fully expect that those states that have may issue will now make their regulations look more like shall issue.
So as we mentioned, this is the court's first major Second Amendment case in more than 10 years. They turned down a number of cases recently. What's the context, not just for today's decision, but for the court's decision to take this up now?
Yeah, well, I mean, this just shows how this court has been completely revolutionized by the Trump appointees. The Trump appointees are clearly ready to take up matters that are really important to conservatives. They are obviously willing to rule in ways that implicate broad swaths of American public policy, and they are somewhat indifferent to whatever sort of political polling or political opinion is on a whole swath of issues. So this is really the conservative majority of the Supreme Court flexing its muscles.
Daryl Miller is a Duke University law professor and co-director of the Duke Center for Firearms Law. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The U.S. Forest Service has issued a mea culpa. In a new report, Chief Randy Moore says his agency failed to account for climate change when it started a planned burn in the Santa Fe National Forest in April. That fire grew out of control and morphed into the Calf Canyon Hermit's Peak Fire, the biggest in New Mexico history. It displaced thousands of people and charred more than 341,000 acres, an area larger than the city of Los Angeles, and it's still burning. Timothy Inglesby is a former Forest Service firefighter, now executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. Timothy, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And what's your take on this report? The government basically acknowledging that it hasn't considered how climate change has dramatically altered fire conditions in the West. How big of a deal is that?
Well, it seems astounding. I can understand why people are upset. It sounds like, you know, the dog ate my homework kind of excuse. But Chief Moore is correct. You know, climate change is creating conditions that's making, you know, managing fire even more challenging than it already is.
Can you help us understand how? I mean, what has climate change done to our forests?
It creates warmer, drier, windier conditions. There's more storms, particularly the Southwest. There's dry lightning storms that come with increased heating. It stresses out the live vegetation with the prolonged droughts. And all these conditions just make vegetation, and particularly the dead down material on the ground surface, easily ignitable. It burns intensely and spreads fire very rapidly.
You know, frankly, we've been hearing about those conditions for many years, though. Why do you think the federal government, the Forest Service, wasn't paying attention to it in terms of how that changed the way it fought fires?
In my opinion, the biggest problem was that this prescribed fire was 16 years too late. That's when they did their original environmental analysis. The burn plan was done years ago. And climate change is just rapidly changing the conditions where fires ignite and burn and spread. And then in the intervening years, they had done some mechanical treatments. They had done a lot of cutting and thinned out trees. And a lot of that fuel was dumped on the ground, adding more fuel to the fire. And so they should have really rechecked the plan. It was far more complex than they assumed. They didn't have enough troops on the ground to manage contingencies. And regardless of the source of that fire, the conditions are such that any source of ignition would have likely caused a wildfire like this. It's just explosive conditions.
And just to back up for a moment, the U.S. Forest Service has been doing these prescribed burns for many decades in this part of the country. The idea is that you thin out dense vegetation in the forest that will reduce the risk of wildfires later. But given what you just described, do you think it would make sense to stop doing prescribed burns in the forest?
Part of our problem is we did exactly that when indigenous burning was stopped forcibly.
And natural burning, essentially.
Know, well, natural burn, yes, by indigenous people who applied fire very intentionally and very adeptly. That was stopped over 100 years ago. And so we've already done that, and we have lots of prescribed burning to catch up because of this fire deficit. It's just that was another problem of this. This prescribed burn is the crews are just pushing it. They were taking a big risk, and, you know, the rest is history.
Okay, so you're saying don't stop. We've already seen what problems that causes. Then in that case, how do we do it better? How do we do it more safely?
That's a good question. First of all, we invest millions, billions into wildfire suppression. I think this fire, we're spending like $5 million per day, and this fire's been going on for months. If we were to shift those resources and that funding into prescribed burning, have as many crews as possible to manage prescribed burning. That would be a big help. And then, you know, we'll never again should we have the excuse we failed to include climate conditions and climate data in our fire management actions. That's just the era we live in.
Timothy Inglesby is a former U.S. Forest Service firefighter, now executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. Timothy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This time last year, activist and author Tarana Burke says she was finally feeling liberated. The founder of the Me Too movement was reveling in the success of her new memoir, Unbound. Then, last Thanksgiving, her 92-year-old grandmother got COVID and died 2 weeks later. At the funeral, Burke and 11 of her family members got sick with COVID too.
I've gone through sort of what I've called my personal tsunami in the last 6 months. And then what's going on in the world has just been a layer.
Here now is Tanya Mosley sat down with Burke for her podcast, Truth Be Told. It was just after the mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. They talked about the immense amount of grief that we've all been feeling.
Grief is a trickster, right?
Mm.
Grief comes and it gets you. It does what it wants with you. It has its way with you, right? Grief will have its way with you, and so you can't plan to navigate grief in any kind of way.
That's right.
Grief and sadness. That's why looking at how people are navigating the world, we lost 1 million people in this country from COVID.
A million.
When you lose 1 million individual people, you leave behind hundreds of millions of mourners. While we are trying to, like, you can't quantify that amount of grief that's just in the air. It's just out there. We're walking around looking at people who are just going on through life, who are carrying that grief. And then you have these mass murders happening around us. And there's that grief, you know. And then so I actually had this moment the other day, and I was texting a friend of mine when the Buffalo mass murder happened. I couldn't talk about it online. I couldn't post about it. I couldn't say anything about it. And, you know, he texted me and he said, I can't go on Twitter because it's just, I'm so sick of the hot takes and the whatnot. And I said, you know what happened to me the other day? I said, I had raw human emotion. And I said, I'm kind of into it. I'm just going to sit with that. The names came up on my phone and I just wept so hard because those names were so Black. They were so Miss Celestine and Miss Pearl. And I just kept putting the Miss before them because they were aunties and neighbors, those are my grandma's church friends, and the lady next door, and the man who fixed your car for free when your carburetor's broken, and you know, those are the girl you went to Sunday school with. I know these Black folks. And my heart broke, and I felt, and it sounds, I don't know how this is going to translate for people, but I felt good about that heartbreak in some ways because I need my heart to break. I need to cry about this. I need to feel bad about it. I don't want to feel numb.
No. So many of us are there. We're there. One thing you shared the last time is that when Me Too became a hashtag and women all over the world began to share their stories online, you were actually really worried about that because you felt like, you know, as someone who has worked with trauma survivors, once you open those wounds, you need guidance and help. We're seeing the same thing play out for every one of us who say, we are not going to go on Twitter or on social. We're going to just grieve. There are many more who have decided, okay, this is the only way that I can emote this intense pain that I'm feeling. Does that also concern you in this moment? And I'm just thinking about how we can be there for each other. We're consuming each other's grief, but we're not connected.
I know. I am absolutely concerned. Not just that we're not connected. We are. This is what I did write about after Texas. We are not built to hold this much. We're not built to know this much, right? Recently, it was a meme that said something about, is it just that there's more trauma or more crisis now? Or is it that social media just gives us more information now? You know, than it was before? Because it feels like it's one after another, after another, after another. And I thought about that and I was like, I'm not sure which is true. Is it that there's more things happening now? But either way, it's too much information.
Yeah,
it's just it's too much happening. And I just don't think human beings are built to hold this much.
How have you been able to get to a place of vulnerability to be able to say, I need help, or to have the people who love you to be able to love you in all the parts of you?
Truth. The truth of some of that is fatigue.
Just so tired of doing it. Yes.
It's just some of it is just plain fatigue. Let me tell you something. I can plainly remember the day I was living in Selma, working at the National Voting Rights Museum. I remember the day that I stood at the top of the steps. We used to plan this huge event called Bridge Crossing Jubilee. It's the commemoration of the Selma to Montgomery March. And I was one of the chief planners of that event. Standing at the top of the steps, and I fell asleep. At the top of the steps. My girlfriend at the time, one of my best friends, was at the bottom of the steps. And she said, are you asleep? she screamed up to the top of the steps. And I woke up. I lived in a perpetual state of exhaustion. Trying to be all the things to all the people all the time. Trying to work and raise my child. And just, it make no sense. In horrible relationships with myself, with the men in my life. I just got to a point of exhaustion. And I can't, even now, there's some things I just can't. My brain, like when I go to try to be this thing or do this thing, be that person, my body says no. My brain says no. I know what you're trying to do. No.
You think it's age now where it's like, okay, look, you've been doing this for too long. You just can't.
Yeah, probably. Probably. My body and brain have conspired now. They're like, oh no, I know what you're trying to do.
Right.
My knees start talking to my ankles, and my ankles be kicking up to my toes, and it shoots right on up to my back, and they say,
But one thing you are so good at is identifying that in other people, though. Like, what do you do when you see that in your friends and the other people that you love, that they're in this same loop of like just overachieving and just working themselves to exhaustion?
You know, the beautiful thing about my friend group now is that we are an amazing circle of truth tellers. I have found myself, I've landed in this beautiful circle of folks who are committed to being honest with each other. But also not just in my friend group, you know, I meet survivors all the time who think they need a thing from me. What they need is a spark to get inside themselves, right? They need a little bit of insight on how to get on this road to figure out how to get back to themselves. And I can hold your hand for 2 seconds or look in your eyes or give you a hug. And I can feel what I need to give you. I don't know what your therapist need to give you or whatever, but the thing that I need to give you, I'm going to give you. Because I've been poured into a lot a lot, a lot, a lot. By the grace of God, people have poured into me for a long, 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 long time.
It's what we can do for each other.
It's what we can do for each other, right? That's all we have. People pour in a little to you, you pour out a little to them. That's just what we have. It's not much, but that's really how we are surviving.
6 months, 7 months away from this time when your life turned upside down, how would you categorize this moment that you're in?
I think I am. I mean, I still probably cry every day about my grandma, like a little bit, not as much. It's not full on, you know, bawling like I was, but I think I'm maybe transitioning a little bit. You know, I'll be 50 next year, and I'm trying to figure out what the next phase of my life is, I guess, the next thing is for me. We're coming up on the 5th anniversary of the hashtag going viral, and we have all of these big plans. So I'm in this space of, feels like everything is about renewal. I want to move into whatever's next for me personally, right? I'm listening to my heart, I'm listening to my body, I'm listening to the universe, to God. Just trying to sit still and listen and like not be numb. I just don't want to be numb. You know, I want to feel things. I want to hear things. I want to connect.
Thank you so much, as always. It has been such a pleasure to be in conversation with you.
Oh, anytime. I really enjoy talking to you. I really do.
That was my conversation with Tarana Burke, founder of the Me Too movement. And you can find every episode of Truth Be Told with Tanya Mosley wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a line in the movie Vacation as Chevy Chase drives his family across the country. He promises that just 4 hours ahead, they'll see the world's second largest ball of twine. Now look, the movie's fiction, but attractions like that are very real. Here's David Kondos of Kansas News Service.
The rural Midwest doesn't have all the natural wonders that can attract tourists to other parts of the country, like oceans, for instance. So to stand out, some towns in Kansas try to manufacture their own larger-than-life wonders.
We've got the world's largest prairie dog in Oakley and the world's largest cow hairball in Garden City. Hutchinson has the world's largest grain elevator, which is also
in the small town of Lucas. Artist Erica Nelson displays her shrine to roadside attractions that bill themselves as the world's largest. And for those, Middle America is a bit of a hotspot. 5 years ago, she opened her own roadside attraction. This collection of nearly 250 miniature giants, aptly named the world's largest collection of the world's smallest versions of the world's largest things. It even has its own theme song. No matter how kitschy, these curiosities offer real boosts to rural economies. They also give communities something to rally around and a feeling that their town, no matter how overlooked, deserves a nod from the outside world. A classic example sits 1 hour north in Cawker City, where thousands of visitors come each year to see the world's largest ball of twine.
You do what you can with what you have, and we have a ball of twine.
That's Linda Clover, the site's caretaker and self-proclaimed belle of the ball. This ball got rolling in 1953 when a farmer didn't know what else to do with leftover twine from hay bales. Today, the twine wrapped around this ball would be long enough to stretch from here to New York City. It weighs nearly 14 tons and is roughly the size of a shuttle bus. And each time she helps a new traveler add their own piece to it, the ball and its fame grow a little bit bigger.
And you have made the ball the biggest it's ever been. You have set a world's record. People love that.
Clover pulls out the ball's guest book and rattles off dozens of far-flung places tourists have come from. California, Florida, Italy, just in the past day or two. And while it might seem, well, unconventional to have a twine ball as your town's claim to fame, Clover says most residents are grateful that it puts them on the map.
It makes them feel good that the world is interested. We all kind of like to think about that somebody cares about us.
It's a similar story across the country. You have the largest peanut in Georgia, largest pistachio in New Mexico, and largest ketchup bottle in Illinois. Cheryl Hargrove, a cultural heritage tourism expert, says a site that gets tourists to pull over and spend a few dollars at the gas station or diner can make a big difference for a small town's economy.
It is having something that does make you different, something that makes you distinctive and, you know, worth a detour.
But the significance goes beyond dollars and cents. Artist Erica Nelson says these attractions resonate with rural Midwesterners because they're a way to show pride in accomplishing something big and unexpected in an often overlooked place. It sends a message that there's much more to the story of places like rural Kansas. And that message isn't just aimed at tourists.
Continually telling your story to outsiders means that you're reminding yourself of why you built it. You're reminding yourself that this is something special.
And rural Kansas isn't done telling that story just yet. Abilene, a cattle drive town east of here, just announced plans to build, wait for it, the world's largest belt buckle. For NPR News, I'm David Kondos in Lucas, Kansas.
The essential part of a federal law known as Title IX is only 37 words long. But when it was signed 50 years ago today, those 37 words transformed education for women and girls. Title IX demanded gender equity at schools. And according to a recent report from the Women's Sports Foundation, 3 million more high school girls can participate in sports because of the law. But that's not all it does. Today, the Biden administration said it would extend Title IX protections to trans students. And that's one area that civil rights lawyer Alexandra Brodsky wanted to see changed. We spoke with her this morning just before the announcement, and we started our conversation with a reading of the law by our producer, Gabrielle Healy.
No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance.
So reflect on that passage for me. What is Title IX's legacy at 50 years?
You know, I think it's amazing how much is encompassed within just that little short plain sentence. Title IX is really broadly worded, and the beauty of that is that over the last 50 years, we've seen advocates and courts recognize all the different kinds of sex discrimination in education that Title IX prohibits. So, you know, as you were saying, a lot of people know about Title IX's protections for women athletes in school, but courts and advocates have also recognized that Title IX protects pregnant and parenting students. It protects LGBTQ students from discrimination. Just last week, we had a big opinion from a federal appeals court saying, hey, Title IX means that you can't require boys and girls to wear different uniforms. And over the last decade or so, we've seen a lot more attention to Title IX's protections for survivors of sexual harassment, which is itself a form of sex discrimination.
In more recent history, the Trump administration made some pretty big changes to the way that Title IX was carried out. They gave more protections for the people who were accused of sexual misconduct on school campuses. I want to play this tape from Education Secretary Betsy DeVos in May of 2020 talking about that.
No incident should ever be swept under the rug. And no student or teacher accused should be punished before evidence proves responsibility.
So could you reflect on that for a moment, the impact of the Trump administration on Title IX, their interpretation of it, and specifically on the issue of sexual abuse on campus?
Sure. So the Trump administration rode this wave of backlash to progress around Title IX and sexual harassment on college campuses and beyond. And they basically turned Title IX into a law that mostly protects people accused of sexual harassment more than it protects people who have experienced it. And to be really clear, of course we should care that investigations by schools or any other institution are fair. The people accused of misconduct, whether it be sexual harassment or otherwise, have their chance to tell their side of the story, the chance to be heard by impartial decision makers. But what the Trump administration did was really go beyond that. They severely limited the rights of sexual harassment survivors. basically letting schools off the hook, saying they don't have to address a ton of sexual harassment. And even when they did have to address some sexual harassment, schools were allowed to do a pretty bad job of it. And then the Trump administration for colleges and universities imposed this one-size-fits-all disciplinary model that looks a lot more like a criminal trial than student discipline for any other kind of misconduct. And that has served to dissuade a lot of survivors from coming forward just because that process is so unnecessarily onerous and adversarial and re-traumatizing.
Right. You founded an organization called Know Your Nine, which helps students understand their rights and also fight for protections under Title IX. I understand a group of you and other students started it after your own experiences with sexual assault on campus. Could you explain how that experience navigating the law changed your own perspective on it?
Absolutely. I mean, I joined some classmates of mine when I was, 20 years old to file a Title IX complaint with the Department of Education against our university for mishandling reports of sexual harassment. And, this was a little over 10 years ago, and just, I will be honest with you, a totally different world. This was a time when, a lot of schools, including mine, didn't even have a publicly identified Title IX coordinator. They had no real infrastructure for handling these kind of complaints.
And this was before the Trump administration, we should also point out, long before Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration made changes. Yeah.
That's absolutely right. And this is, actually right when the Obama administration was starting to ramp up its own enforcement efforts. And, which I think put a lot of pressure on schools to get up to speed and finally start taking these responsibilities seriously. And I think it was really powerful for me as a young person to see the way that, using the law could be really effective. And, that's not to put too much import on the law or to denigrate other kinds of social change. But it was just amazing to me that after years of protests, years of petitions that our school administration had managed mostly to ignore, that when we filed this legal complaint, suddenly they had to show up. And that certainly influenced my decision to become a lawyer. And I now spend a lot of my practice representing students.
Well, 50 years later, we are at an important time for Title IX again, because we expect the Biden administration to reverse some of the Trump-era interpretations of the law and to also include new protections for trans student under Title IX. What kind of reforms would you like to see?
Oh, so many. So, I think that the baseline is returning to some of the better standards that we saw before the Trump administration that were consistent over decades of Republican and Democratic administrations before that. So that's things like restoring the old, broader definition of sexual harassment, holding schools to a higher standard on what a good job they're supposed to do when they respond. But I think we have to look beyond that. So in terms of sexual harassment, one thing that I'm really hoping to see in these new rules is greater protections for survivors from retaliation. We hear so many stories about survivors who report that they've been sexually assaulted, and they end up being the ones who are punished because their schools find out that they were drinking at the time of the sexual assault, because their schools don't believe them and so think that the students have admitted to having consensual sex on school grounds. And, those kind of, punishments really discourage a lot of victims from coming forward. So I'm hoping that the new rules will clarify that Title IX's prohibition on retaliation encompasses that kind of discipline. And then, as you said, we're really hoping and expecting to see the Biden administration codifying these regulations that Title IX protects LGBTQ students from discrimination. Because even though that seems to be pretty obviously legally right based on recent decisions from the Supreme Court, the Trump administration really resisted providing these kinds of protections to trans and queer youth. And, students and families shouldn't have to feel like their rights are dependent on who is in the White House on any given day.
It is interesting to watch the evolution of this political battle. There is this new fight over gender in sports and education. Many Republican states are passing laws targeting trans children. There are some trans girls that will be unable to compete on girls' teams. There's, this ongoing fight over who can use what bathroom. What do you think the next chapter of Title IX is going to look like in this country?
You know, I am choosing to be optimistic. I think that lawyers and advocates for trans students have been really effective so far in convincing courts that Title IX really means equality, that Title IX means that trans students should be able to use facilities and participate in teams consistent with their gender identity. But I will be honest with you that it has just been killing me to see, let's say, these Republican governors passing laws prohibiting trans students from participating in sports, pretending that they are champions of Title IX, pretending that they are champions of women's sports when they have not paid an ounce of attention to girls' access to athletics for any genuine reason and are only using these putative concerns to discriminate against trans students.
That was civil rights lawyer Alexandra Brodsky. We spoke earlier today just before the White House said it would overturn those Trump-era guidelines for sexual assault allegations and extend Title IX protections to trans students. We'll have more coverage at hereandnow.org.
Despite years of efforts to diversify their industry, the proportion of black doctors in this country has not changed in more than 40 years. Only about 5% of our doctors are black. A new investigation by STAT, the health and medicine publication, finds black medical residents are leaving or getting kicked out of residency programs at far higher numbers than their white counterparts. Joining us now is Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, president and CEO of the Morehouse School of Medicine. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. I assume that the stats findings don't surprise you, that black medical residents are more likely to leave or be forced to leave these training programs.
So I will say I am not surprised anytime that we can raise awareness to what we see a disproportionate negative impact on our trainees. We need to raise that awareness. It was probably about 4 or 5 years ago, a group of us who attend the historically black medical schools who are leaders there went to the ACGME to raise some concerns about this increased percentage that we saw.
And the ACGME is the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education.
Correct.
Yeah, for those who are not doctors, who are not in the medical field, can you explain why this matters? When we're talking about training programs, someone outside the industry might not realize how important these residencies are.
Well, one of the things you know is that when you're going to medical school, first of all, you're going to have done 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, and then you, on match day, get your choice of residency training. So it's something that you've been preparing for a long period of time. So they go into these training programs and they expect that it's going to be hard. No one expects that it's not going to be, but they also expect that they're walking into an equitable learning environment. And one of the things that we've seen is that there is definitely not equity sometimes in the assessments when you look at compared to white residents versus black residents. And once you are labeled, quote unquote, in a residency training program, it can follow you throughout the 2, 3, 4, 5 years of your training, which will lead to potentially an increased chance of someone deciding at the program level that you should not continue. And we definitely see this as disproportionately blacks are more likely to be dismissed as compared to whites.
And so then what effect does that have on their careers as they move forward? What is the fallout from this?
The fallout is that some of them actually don't get to go to another training program. And so they don't get to complete a residency training program. And they really have a lot of debt from medical school and they have to figure out how they're going to pay that off. But they have to have different career choices. Now, when we look at the data, and there have not been a lot of reports that look at this, probably about 60% of them end up identifying another residency training program and are able to make it through. But that does mean that 40% do not. But I think the greater challenges and opportunity for us is, first of all, to understand why this is happening, and then to understand the impact that it has on diversifying the workforce. And we know when we see concordance in Black providers with their patients, or there's concordance in gender, we see better patient outcomes. And so we want to make sure that we actually are not decreasing the opportunity for improved patient outcomes by not having a workforce that is reflective of this country and of the communities that our providers are serving in.
So the medical industry has been aware of the problem of diversity for a very, very long time. There have been a number of different efforts to try to address that, to bring up the percentage of doctors who are Black. And we're still here with 5% of the doctors being Black. And that has real world consequences to the kind of healthcare that patients receive. What are we missing? What is the medical field not doing that it should be doing?
Well, one of the things is that we have to be more actionable and hold institutions accountable. In the last 15 years, there have been probably 15 to 18 new medical schools, and all of them had diversity and inclusion as a part of their mission. Yet they moved the needle less than 0.05% for increasing the number of Black or brown students who attended the medical schools. Now, what we're doing at Morehouse School of Medicine, we're expanding our medical school. We started a partnership with Common Spirit Health, the second largest not-for-profit health system in this country. And what we are going to do is open up 5 regional medical campuses. We are going to see, as we build out these programs, over 300 more Black residents, and you will see us doubling our medical school size. So right now we have 110 students per year. We will go up to 225 students over the next 5 years.
Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice is president and CEO of the Morehouse School of Medicine. Dr. Rice, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.